At the beginning. Was that loud enough?
I think so.
Volume is on the side.
Yeah, it's on to... It's...
No, sorry, volume is the two at the top.
So what's that volume there then?
Well, it's just up and down, doesn't it?
I thought I'd just get straight onto this like riding a bike.
Here we are. It's a very high volume.
Yes. Better high than low. Yes. Well, thank you very much, Marilyn, for agreeing to this interview. Just once again for the tape, this is the 1st of May 2024. Liz Chappell and Lynn Walker speaking with Marilyn Pidgeon at her home at 52A Lynch's Road, Armidale. Now, Marilyn, I thought we might speak first of all about your personal garden journey and then lead on to your public life, which was heavily influenced by gardening as well. Can we start with your early life and the influences towards gardening? Perhaps the garden you grew up in?
Yes, certainly. Oh, there was more than one. yes, I was... born in Launceston in 1941, and of course that was well into the war when people were really focusing on the essentials. I can remember parks being dug up for trenches in Launceston, would you believe, and various other things that had an impact on my early life. My parents gardened very enthusiastically, before breakfast on work days and a lot of each weekend. And, of course, I was the only child, so I went into the garden with them. And from the age of three, I think, I was already collecting plants from neighbours. And some of those plants travelled several gardens further on in my personal history. And I knew names of things very early. I think my mother made sure that I knew what I was. I could recognise what I loved. From there, when I was four, we left a simply wonderful garden, which had marvellous trees and shrubs and towers of rhododendrons and deep, deep beds of lily of the valley, and just a delight for a small child with my bent. And we went to what was in effect a non-garden. As someone said, a newspaper article said, we were hugely lucky to actually have a house, despite the fact that it was cream and orange and pink. They didn't have time to paint it properly before the war began, and you couldn't get paint afterwards. But I was heavily involved in the planting of that garden. And I think that I could probably mentally walk round that garden now and name every plant. Sides, back, front, the lot.
Now, being wartime, was it a decorative garden as well as a productive garden, or was it...
Oh, it was mostly decorative, but there was a big, big veggie garden too. And in the garden book, a personal family book that my sisters and I published, we all made note of how important gardens were at that time. Everybody had a vegetable garden, and they grew the basics. In Tasmania, it was potatoes and carrots and cabbages and all the usual things. My mother insisted on growing corn and yams. I don't know where yams came from. And there were fruits and... currants and strawberries and raspberries. In Tasmania, you had raspberries whether you liked them or not, because they invaded from the next house if you didn't have them. Fruit trees, and oh dear, I can remember that the street gang, I was the youngest and therefore badly led, we raided, and everybody could provide information about the gardens in the street and what was available at the time. And because Tasmania has very long twilights, we could be raiding at 9:30 at night. And whether it was the Cross Scotswoman's nectarines or the first peas or strawberries, which were much more luxurious than raspberries, we raided and consequently were well filled. I do remember also there was a poor man who was foolish enough to start a vegetable garden on a very steep slope, not very far from our place, and people could buy their vegetables direct from him. And he had the same sorts of veggies, but because it was not on an incredibly steep site, too steep for roads, he enjoyed the aspect of the northern aspect on marvellous basalt soil, and he had very early peas and very early carrots and very early lettuces. And, of course, you harvested your own, and most went down the gullet before they got back to the kitchen. So that was another interesting family memory that is virtually not replicated at all these days, except, I suppose, for people who sometimes let people harvest their own. Mm-hmm. So that was that garden. We moved several times, and each time I can remember I looked at what was in the garden. That was the most important thing for me. I nearly wept tears of blood when my parents didn't buy a highly unsuitable house, which had forests of rhododendrons, and it was just a dream for me. But no, they said they didn't need 12 bedrooms or whatever it had. So we had moved on to a more humble environment. By that time, my mother was incredibly busy. My father was often absent, and I was let loose on a near bare garden site. And I had already been drawing garden plans down the margins of my poetry books and taking huge interest in the gardens of the families that we visited, often repeatedly, and some wonderful gardens we visited. And they all influenced me both in plant material and design. So by my trick year, I spent quite a lot of time designing gardens. I couldn't do architecture. There was none offered. The course wasn't offered at the University of Tasmania, and my parents then, with five daughters, certainly weren't going to entertain the idea of me doing architecture. So I diverted myself with pen and paper.
Now, landscape architecture or horticulture at a tertiary level weren't available.
No, they weren't available. But to me, always, the house went with the garden. And so I was looking at aspect and tree types and the soil and the general views and the general environment. So that was experience of a sort. Then I went off to uni. And the routes to uni, we lived halfway up Mount Wellington, out my college was, not on the university side. It was the only one that was off the university. And we had to either walk or bus to one of the two university sites. And I...
Just interrupting, this is in Hobart now.
Yes. I chose mostly to walk. It was a hard decision because I wore out so much leather, the shoe repairer's bill was probably much the same as the bus fare. I walked chiefly because I loved choosing the route to go past different gardens in season. And, of course, it was a wonderful place to walk from the top of Davie Street, which leads onto the mountain road, down into, first of all, through the city, and then to Sandy Bay, through these wonderful old gardens with their stone walls and stone houses and trees even then 150 years old. So there again I was garnering ideas, and my rooms at college in the various years overlooked simply wonderful things, both in views and in plant material. And then... sometime after that, I was married, and my husband John decided after some very interesting prospects in Canada and Africa, we decided we'd move 25 miles upstream to New Norfolk, which was a little bit of a letdown, but he had a very interesting job as he switched from research to production engineering. New Norfolk was a terrible shock.
Which year was this that you were married?
1965 we were married, and we moved mid-65. We were given a house, which was just lovely. We were given terribly green wood to burn in our fireplace. And I started making something of that garden. But it was hard yards because it was hugely frosty, frigid, pea soup fogs that lasted 3 days. And then in the summer, with no sea breezes of any sort, it was boiling hot. But I battled, and I had a veggie garden and a few bits and pieces, but nothing special, although I noticed the resident keen gardener visited me before we left to ask if he could take all the specimens big enough, small enough to move. So that told me that I'd got some things right. And then we went even worse to Newcastle in 1966, I beg your pardon. And that was a terrible shock. Not only could I not recognise seasons, of course seasons were there, but not in my terms, but we had a very challenging house, and the city was grimy, dirty, it was union-dominated, it had no cultural life almost at all. Some very funny experiences there which don't apply to this talk, but it just highlighted the fact that you had to make friendships and find interests of your own.
Because Newcastle was dominated by the steelworks at
that
point.
Yes, and they were all rust bucket economy. So the threat, Damocles' sword, was hanging over these businesses, Commonwealth Steel and BHP and so forth, all of them gone now, long ago in fact. It was hard. I tried to grow roses and they all got flooded by the heavy rain because the bottom of our garden was at the bottom of a gully and we were halfway up the gully. And I didn't know enough about soils, but it was a good learning experience. My second son, who was born there and a toddler, he was of the arch naughty type from birth. And one day when I was just at my wit's end, I thought, I know what I can do to entertain you. So I put him in the front garden, which was childproofed, and I gave him the hose. And it was a very happy arrangement for some time until I heard an unusual noise. And on investigation, I found that he'd brought the hose inside and he was hosing the sitting room. So he didn't have quite the sensitivity that I had when I was his age. So then we John was very keen to start a new business, which was not the news agency. It was growing eucalypts for an industry producing essential oils. I had stupidly given him an annual gazetteer that highlighted all the major facts of Australia's development in 1968 or something, and he discovered to his horror that Australia imported 90-something percent of its eucalypt oil, which he thought was a national disgrace. And being a chemical engineer, when he read up, he could see that, or maybe he knew already, that the production process was a cinch, but growing the plants was not. And he did a lot of reading and a lot of travelling. We all did a lot of travelling as he researched this. But we could see it was going to take a great deal of money to get this set up. So he decided that the best way to do it was to take over the business in Armidale from his father, which was very profitable. And what little spare time he had was sunk into the business of eucalypts, the getting appropriate eucalypts. He settled on a particular kind of oil, which was produced, as it happened, by a eucalypt that was native to the Niangla area. Very fine quality oil. But he had to have, and I've forgotten the name of the eucalypt, the particular eucalypt, I can check it. But he started trying to grow from seed. And it was some funny experience. This is getting a bit away from my experience, but it all came home to roost. He had to collect seed, but they were too high. He tried ladders and throwing things. And in the end, he bought himself a 243 shotgun, and he would shoot off the branch out, you know, way out in the sticks to gather the better kinds of nuts. And then we had plots all round in many places.
But so around the Armidale region?
Going out to Ebor, yes, mm-hmm. yes. But that was no good either, because they were so various and he couldn't monitor them. And at that stage, he became aware of a fellow called Ron de Fossard. Now, Ron was a botanist at uni, and he had recently developed what was the essence of the cloning industry. And he had schools both here in Armidale, and hundreds of people came from all over the world. And he also went all over the world to give courses in Hawaii and America and Israel, I think, China, but certainly many, many places. It was an absolute breakthrough in the industry. And no one in the early years had cracked the code for the cloning of eucalypts. And that's what John started to do. And he built a state-of-the-art laboratory, the same as Ron had out at uni. And we had laminar flow cabinets and autoclaves and all sorts in a space that was built beyond the garage. So that was very important to us as the family grew up and John focused on these things. It also meant we travelled widely again, because if he was going to grow it commercially, he knew he had to do it in an automated way. So we went to the Narada Tea Factory way up in North Queensland to look at their hedging systems and the machinery that they had. We went down into ACT where he looked at some of the old boys' work, and they were both subsistence exercises, really, but he was able to look at the different kinds of eucalypts. He read very widely, and it was a particular interest for him. Whereas I started off in Garibaldi Street. We lived there for 6 years, 6.5 years, and I had my own good fortune. The garden had some lovely substantial trees, and the woman who had redeveloped the garden was the wife of the fellow who was head of agricultural economics, Lewis, John Lewis. And she had come from Canberra, so the garden was planted with the things that good advice had been given in Canberra to her. I started my collections. I can remember very early on, because we arrived in July, I was desperate to get something colourful in the garden, and I bought polyanthus. And I can remember it started to snow one night, and I rushed out to cover them. I soon learned that it wasn't snow, it was frost that was the problem. I tried growing cinerarias, and goodness me, they lasted only a minute and a half. But I learned lots of things, and I started collecting. And on that subject, I was hugely fortunate that John's childhood neighbour was a friend of John's mother, Sue Curtis, and she gave me rare things like regal lilies, almost unobtainable these days. She gave me peonies, which I'd hankered for because my mother had a few peonies that travelled with us to our various gardens. And she introduced me to tree peonies. I'd never heard of a tree peony. And, of course, that was a compounding effect in my focusing my interest. And I collected camellias and some roses. I was very lucky in that Carl Taylor, who had retired into Armidale, into Galloway Street, was having to move, and he was a great rosarian, won all the first prizes at all the shows that were available, and he had to move, and he heard that the garden was going to be bulldozed for a house extension, and he arrived at my doorstep, this tiny little very gracious gentleman, to beg me to take his roses. So I said, yes, please. My father happened to be staying, so that together we dug 14, I think, of the least big roses, and I still have some here at this address. Another person who was very helpful to me was Margaret Smith, who was also of the botany department. Now, she was a professional horticulturalist, as was her husband, Noel. And she was a rosarian of great knowledge and also an expert in bulbs. And she taught me about the basal propagation of bulbs, something I'd never even dreamed of. She also encouraged me to become a member of the Royal Horticultural Society. Now, I couldn't go to any of its meetings or its garden visits, but the overseas people got the second prize of a catalogue with, I think to begin with, it was 80 packets of seeds from Kew that they collected. So I grew my own first tree peonies from seed from Kew. Wow. I grew rare bulbs, particularly crocuses, autumn crocuses as well as spring crocuses, and many, many, many other things. And it was a great delight to me to, first of all, get the catalogue, and there'd be about 1,400 choices. And I thought, how is this going to get into Australia? But the blurb said that they could send it anywhere, and in those days I didn't even know about aqueous. And everything came through except there was one missing, with a little note from the immigration people to say this rare Swiss oxalis was persona non grata. Comes from Switzerland, it won't hurt here, but no, I never saw that. It was burnt.
Or ended up in someone's garden.
Or, yes, that's true, it could be so. That was another thing that Margaret gave me, an insight into those things.
Now, of course, that wasn't in your present garden here.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yes. It started in Garibaldi Street. I knew her well by then through Women Grads, and then because of my great interest, we kept in good touch. Yes.
When did you move here?
1970. July 1970. No, November 1970.
I remember you telling a lovely story about moving here with loads of trees going past other people's. Could you repeat that one for the tape?
Yes. Well, the moving men came and looked at our fairly small, humble house. And they said, oh, yes, one truck, a middle-sized truck. And I said, I think you'll need more than that because some of my antique furniture is very heavy and big. And I had told them I wanted the pots moved. And they just didn't take any notice. Not only did we not need, only one truck, I think it was three trucks for the household equipment, and they had to go and get another truck for the pot plants. And a friend of mine who lives en route was sitting having a morning or afternoon tea with a friend, and she looked out beyond her hawthorn hedge and said, apropos of nothing in particular, to the friend, oh, the pigeons are moving. And she looked, and all she could see was Burnham Wood passing Dunsinane beyond the hawthorn hedge. But on the subject of the moving, I'd moved a huge amount of material here, and I did what I thought, in retrospect, was a very good thing, a sensible thing, believe it or not. I had a whole truck of sand deposited in a nest of trees, gum trees, and it was quite, 4 or 5 feet high. And as I decided I'd take things, I brought them up here and put them in that sand, bearing in mind this is autumn going summer, autumn into winter. And I only had the one place to keep moist. And then once I needed, I could leave them there until it was the season and I had the right place for them to move out. So that reduced the element of frenetic activity with the garden, because I could do it at a better pace.
By then you'd been in Armidale for several years.
Yes, and 6 years. And when I designed the house and the garden, and as you would imagine, I was designing the house with the garden, or the garden with the house. And there were things I had very clearly in mind. One was the aspect of the house, so that every living room in this house and all but one other room have access to morning, middle day, afternoon sun. But I also knew that I needed shelter from the sun in summer. So we left some giant eucalypts at the western side of the house. And until the trees that I planted in between them had grown to a sufficient height, they stayed. But they were all white gums, and they dropped their limbs in a very dangerous, unexpected way, and eventually they all had to go. But that took about 10 years for us to thin them out. So the garden, of course, as for most people, started near the house and moved out, except for line of the trees at the back, which was to be a windbreak, and the specimen trees. And thereby hangs a tale. When I started to dig for these trees, I had a teaspoon of soil for every ton of rock. And so I got Mr. Briggs, wonderful Mr. Briggs, to come and with his backhoe, and he dug 50 holes along the back fence line for the turuloses, and he dug specimen holes, holes for the specimen trees that I'd already pre-planned to the west and the north of the house.
So were you working to a plan for the entire block from the beginning?
No, a concept. There had been a tennis court at the far end of the garden, but little corners of it were on other properties, because all this had been owned by the one property once. And so the tennis court, which had two huge cotoneasters growing in the middle of this ex-tennis court and was used by the chooks for roosting at night, that became a thing of the past. It was pulled down, and we planned to have a tennis court a bit closer to the house, but when the tennis court man came some years after we'd got established, He said, oh, well, all those trees will have to go. They'd ruin my court, he said. So we sent him away and we bought a croquet set instead. And that was very satisfactory because two of my four tennis-playing friends had courts and they enjoyed croquet as well. So that's how the croquet, the croquet lawn came to replace the tennis court. The pond was not planned. My middle son was at uni and looking for money-earning jobs, and then he came and helped me build the stone walls. He in fact built them. I made the mistake of insisting that they all be basalt to match the soil type here, which meant we travelled thousands of kilometres, in fact, out to Ebor, up to Glencoe, out west, looking for flat basalt. And I'm sure it was illegal, but and future archaeologists are going to be very puzzled about the source, geologists are going to be sort of troubled about what they find here. And at one point, Philip said to me, as he and a friend sank some huge slabs into place, you know, Mum, basalt's four times the density of granite. He said since he was exaggerating, but he wanted to make a point. So the pond was his baby. I'd said I wanted. Oh, that's right. He asked me what I wanted for Mother's Day or birthday. He didn't have any money, and I said, "Well, I would like that pond." And we'd all talked about a pond, but not agreed about the site or the type. So he took off, and I said, I want a perfectly round pond with coping stones around the flat edge over near the birch trees. What I got was a kidney-shaped, two-tone, two-levelled monster. But couldn't be changed. But it is a... It's a wonderful resource and brings huge numbers of birds. Mm. And on the subject of birds, I should say I've kept a register over the years, and I have 46 species of bird that I've seen, quite a lot of them only once or twice, and some that were common once, almost non-existent now, others in huge, huge, worrying hooligan packs, but that's nature.
I'll just take you back one little step. Yes, when you said the basalt was a mistake, I presume you meant for the distance you had to travel and the weight of it to handle.
Yes.
You weren't disappointed with the end result?
No. We're very happy. We all love it. So we arrived here, and very quickly John built the laboratory, and we were all very busy working, and the kids helped a lot too. Andrew, my eldest son, is extremely methodical, orderly. He was given the job of mowing lawns, which he did perfect. Well, they weren't lawns, though, it was mown paddock. His next brother, the one who hosed my sitting room, he delighted in drawing patterns in the grass with the lawnmower, and it nearly drove his older brother mad. But it only lasted a few years, and of course off they went. So that was...
So this garden that we can admire from the window is really the fruition of your gardening knowledge that was acquired. Yes. Could you take us for a virtual walk around in our minds and point out the highlights?
Well, I'll try. I guess the problem for me is I'm not a plant designer and I'm not just a plant collector. And when you do both, there are some awful conflicts and some terrible mistakes, like looking out right now at that Sequoia sempervirens, which is about 80, perhaps 90 feet high, planted right where it can take all of, a lot of the sun, winter sun, that I'd so carefully placed the house for. It should have gone right down into the northeast corner where it would have been admired and not abused, but it's too big to do anything about it now. And when I designed it, the terrace was obviously, I knew it was going to be much used because the house at Garibaldi Street had a similar shaped terrace, a U-shaped terrace. So we always have a sheltered place or a sunny place, and the pergola provides sun in the winter. And the trees now, we've actually pulled off the, first of all, the wisteria, white wisteria, which went so berserk it was coming in the house and getting under the tiles above the second story. And it's still coming up. Well, it would be 35 years, maybe longer, that have gone since we thought we'd removed it. And ditto the ornamental grape. It's still trying to shoot. So these things can hang around for a long time. But the trees are now doing the job that they were supposed to do. On the western side, we had a lawn and then what I called the mound, because that's where I shoved all the mowings and stuff to make soil. The trees in that mound are now substantial and give us beautiful summer shade, and so that this place simply doesn't need air conditioning. It has triple skin walls, and that helps, and now double glazing, but it's the trees that make the big difference.
Now, under those trees, which are...
Well, there's a linden, an ash, a scarlet oak, Indian deodar. There was a metasequoia, which died in one of the droughts. There are there's a dogwood and a cornus capitata, the evergreen, or is it cusa? Anyway, the evergreen dogwood. And under it, in this mound, this mulch, I have bulbs that flower. There would only be perhaps one, maybe 2 months of the year when I don't have flowers, going from winter right through to the licorice, the orange licorice, yes, in late February, early March. So, and the management, the leaves, the sun means not much growth occurs in summer. There's a big patch of hellebores too, and in winter they get the sun and they flower. So it's a minimum care bed, which is very satisfactory. I might wade in to get the windblown weeds, you know, once every pancake day, but essentially it's self-managing. So that was a good thing to do. I also had what, in front of the house, there's a lawn which is there deliberately to give access to the sun, and about 60 feet beyond was where the shrubbery started. And I wanted to have a sort of thickery, you know, walking through trees. And I was giving a talk somewhere, and I commented that in my reading I'd come across an anecdote about some crusty old English earl who had given a landscape designer the challenge of planting a new, massive new avenue going to his splendid baronial pile of stone or bricks. And the man carelessly went away, he went away on holiday or did something else, and when he came back, he looked at the specimens and he said, "The blighter, he's planted for his satisfaction and not my great-grandchildren." In other words, he looked for a short-term effect, yes, and not the long-term effect. And another account that I read that I loved was Lord Rothschild, who was a world expert in rhododendrons. He said to one of his, gave a talk to his club in London, and he said very earnestly, all gentlemen, no matter how small their estate, should have a woodland of no less than 7 acres. And I thought, well, that's not much use to us. So there are scales of things, but you can still apply the principle that, you know, you need these little escapes and little conceits and puzzles in the garden.
Well, you've evidently been very influenced by English gardens and English garden plants. Is there also a place for Australian plants in this garden?
Well, they're here, yes. The eucalypts, of course, went, but I'm just trying to think. I've got a few that... can't think what they are now, but not many, obviously. Yes, I suppose my Tasmanian upbringing meant that that was what, first of all, I wanted to replicate, and then I started reading more widely and travelling, which showed me other plants to aim at. So that was, I guess... Oh, and I should say that I found that the camellias, particularly the japonicas, do really well on the south side of both the house and our garage. They just love it, even despite the effect of lime and so forth close to the planting. It's a really good position, a good site to put them in.
What were some of the limitations of the New England climate that have sort of frustrated your gardening?
Oh, well, obviously the frost. I've learned to live with that. One of the problems was that this site, which is a very peculiar shape, a sort of odd battle axe block, it had an enormous avenue to its north. And I had to plant anything that was in the shade of that avenue had to be drought tolerant and shade loving. And when the trees had to go about 12 or 15 years ago, little by little, because they died, or they were dying, or they became dangerous, or they blew over, or neighbourhood kids burnt them, suddenly the garden I'd planted hated it, the things that I put in this shade, and I really had to start planting again, which has made the garden always out of balance. It irks me no end. It's too late for me to achieve what I wanted to do in the first place. I've tried, and perhaps if I'm lucky, whoever takes over this place will have the garden as well, and they will see what could be possible, but more likely it'll be cut up into tiny blocks. So that was a problem. The wind... When the avenue was here, we had a wonderfully sheltered garden once the bacteriolosis grew up. But, of course, the wind is much more damaging now than it used to be. Drought is just terrible on this place because there's so little soil. It is impossible, really, to provide enough water. In the last drought in 2019, I had about 8 buckets of water for me, cooking, washing, and the garden. I mean, it was sick making, and I think I actually went into a sort of depression because I didn't realise how much the planning of the garden and the ongoing activity of the garden was such a positive influence in my life. Always moving forward, always looking to the next season or the next year. And suddenly I couldn't do any of those things. I had no idea, no confidence that it would actually get better in time for me to save the things I had. So the lack of water has been terrible. The lack of soil has been terrible. The exposure has been terrible. But you've got to live with what you've got. And,
of course, the great love of your gardening life, the peonies, have a place not only in your personal garden but turned into a commercial venture for you.
Yes, could we talk about that a little later?
Yes, certainly.
So just a couple of things I wanted to refer to before we do that. I guess looking at my personal history, when I was on council for quite a long time, and so I was involved in a lot of projects and crises and so forth.
Can we just mention which years you were on council?
Oh, yes.
Broadly
80,
speaking.
Yes, 74 to 83. Three terms Crikey. Of 3 years.
Mm.
I think the first... yes, I wanted to talk about, if I can,
sure.
the business of... Well, we'll do the dieback first. The dieback problem became a matter of real public concern in the 70s. I can't remember which year it was, but the concern was so great that... we had a public meeting and more than 600 people attended in the town hall. For my sins, I was heavily involved in that because no one else on council had much of an interest at all in gardening. We had a council community committee which set up fundraising, and we raised over $80,000 in 6 weeks at the same time that the town was raising money for Niram, and that would date it more or less. So I thought that was a hugely significant thing that this tiny community, comparatively speaking, could put its hand in its pocket to such a great extent. Now, that money went, the money from the committee's fundraising, went to several programs at the university where they were trying to work out what the major influences, contributors were to this program. And, of course, they found it was a multi-layered, interrelated set of issues. Some people were already concerned, and I heard, I think, that someone said, you need at least 7 acres, and it was acres then, of natural woodland to keep the various species of birds and insects alive. They found it was something like 70 acres per square kilometre. So, probably mixed my terms, but you can see that it was a tenfold increase in the understood need for an ecology that would maintain sufficient species to be predators of the, particularly the dieback beetle.
Now, just for the record, I'll point out here that we were looking just at the Armidale Council,
yes.
which was a
yes.
city council.
That's right.
So that makes that magnitude of fundraising
yes.
quite amazing.
Yes.
Because the rural area surrounding was still Dumeric Council.
We had farmers involved. It was a district thing.
Oh, right, not
Definitely.
Just an Armidale Council.
In fact,
council.
Probably more than a district. I think you could say a New England thing. Wherever dieback was serious, people came.
Oh, thank you for that clarification.
And at the same time, the tailors were embarking on a really serious program to revegetate their own property, and in turn, of course, it became revegetating a lot of other people's properties. So the dieback issue, and of course we had the interest of the eucalypts, which made us particularly aware, and in fact John and I went to John and Vicky Taylor's first open day on the perishing cold day, but it was bare hilltops, and I've been to those hilltops since, and they are covered with forests. So it's wonderful to see the changes that can be wrought with energy and some money. So that was one thing, the dieback. Another thing, yes, the International Year of the Tree. Now, that occurred while I was on council too, and again, guess who had to be chair of that? We had a public open day on the then totally ignored arboretum at the western end. We had 1,400 people on the first day of August, and I think it was -5 that morning, so it says a great deal about the local interest in trees. And that's where No, I don't think Maria was involved with that. I'm sure she would have been there.
Mm.
But from that event, council reactivated its Arboretum Committee. Well, it had another public meeting, and it was decided that we would have a new program for the Arboretum. And again, I had, because I was on council, I chaired that up till, until 88, end of 88. And there had been a plan by someone called Margules, who came from Margules. He was a Canberra landscape gardener, and he had a notional plan. It simply divided the Arboretum into a western general use area. The next area was to be indigenous plants and water gardens, and the eastern area was to be exotic plants. But that was virtually the only indicator. There might have been some comments about soils, but it really wasn't. It didn't go into any more depth than that. There had been a small committee, maybe the early 60s, which had done a little bit of planting at the western end, but it virtually all died. A few of the conifers stayed, but that was it. So we had Margul's plan, and we had an enthusiastic section of the community, and we had to find a way of progressing this. Shortly after that, Bill McCarthy, the local state member, he chose that to put half of the bicentennial money that came from the federal and state government, he chose to put it towards the Arboretum, and the other half was to go to the Aboriginal keeping place. I think he thought he was sort of spreading his bets and doing the least damage to people's sensibilities, perhaps, I don't know. But anyway, he chose. So we now had a budget of $450,000, but we had to match it. We thought, we'll never do that. But through cash, labour, goods in kind, we did. And whether it was Richard Belfield and his bulldozer, or it was school kids planting daffodils, or it was service clubs providing money for trees, or PLC girls coming down for their some particular aspect of their education in a bus. If they didn't have trowels, they'd have soup spoons from the kitchen. to plant the bulbs. There was a huge amount of activity, and we got it going. The terrible downside was, well, there was one funny thing. We looked at the water gardens, and we knew we had no capacity to do any of that. So we found that a former, recently resigned national curator of the National Botanic Gardens in Canberra had set up a consultancy in Coffs Harbour, and we could just afford to bring him up for a day, in fact several days, and he designed the water gardens, and he envisaged a series of ponds dropping from Garibaldi Street down to the highway. And we knew that there was water there because there were two ponds where my children had caught crabobs for years when we lived at Garibaldi Street. And that gave him the idea for having ponds in steps and stairs. And his idea was they would be mirror ponds, and you could sit at any level and have the landscape and the skyscape reflected off the pools. And we said, we can't afford that. And he said, well, what can you afford? And we said, very, very little. So we designed one pond at the bottom And when he gave us the costings for that, that was $450,000. And we said, how could it be? And he said, well, you've got to have it lined. And most of the cost is in the butyl liner, which is a very, very heavy rubber that's used for the inner tyres of cars. And I said, well, we just can't afford it. And he said, well, you won't have a pond. And I said, what's wrong with an agricultural pond? And he said, if you think you can have an agricultural pond built doesn't leak, go to it. So I rang Richard Belfield, who said, yes, yes. He came and had a look, and he said, yes, 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 we can build a pond there. So he got out his very best and largest bulldozer and took it down, and he made a magnificent deep pond. And it was all very satisfactory, and someone built the bridge across, and we got stones from down near Bendemeer to make the lip of the waterfall, which is also John Wrigley's design. And it was marvellous until I heard Richard talking one day, recounting his version of these events, and I heard him label the bulldozer Marilyn. So, he was a friend, but it was a little bit dicey for a while.
Just to clarify, John Wrigley was the consultant from Coffs Harbour.
John Wrigley, yes, W. He had just retired from the National Botanic Gardens, and he established a consultancy in Coffs Harbour. Yeah. He also worked with the Coffs Harbour Bicentennial Committee, and being close, he gave a great deal more advice and probably plant material. And it's a very humbling experience to compare that's a botanic garden, but with this arboretum. Whereas here, our town clerk, who was the great controller, was very unwilling. He felt the money should have gone elsewhere, and he dragged his heels, and it was not a happy situation. In Coffs Harbour, the council has been very supportive. They now have 3 professional permanent gardeners, and they have a team of 200 volunteers. So these programs, they can start off with the Vision Splendid, but unless you have that administrative backing and a lot of active goodwill in the community, it isn't going to go very far. But we have preserved the Arboretum. At one point, when I first got onto council and I was chairman of Planning and Development, I found a map under a former mayor's reign, which had it all being divided up for a subdivision. And that was when I realised something had to be done. I think that was all that I wanted to say about that.
Can I just ask a question? Who then gave the land? Was it council land?
Oh, it was gazetted as public open space. Yes.
So how did he have the power to have...
Oh, because it was council's... council administers the open space, and I suppose they thought... the proposer probably thought they could get it rezoned. And maybe they could, I don't know, but it seemed the wrong thing to do. Not so much that Armidale was lacking parks. In fact, for our ratepayer base, we have too many. It's just a terrible, terrible burden. I think it was 47% of the small Armidale City Council, when it was 13 square kilometres, 47% was institutional land. And there was a very, very tiny ratepayer base to provide all the things that this well-travelled, well-informed community insisted we ought to have. So, we saved the Arboretum, and for populations in the future, that will be a great resource, like the creek lands. And when money becomes available, it will be developed further.
So would you consider that one of your greatest achievements on council?
No. No, it was done. I don't know. I don't think I'd say anything was a great achievement, but it was certainly, it took up a lot of time. So that took us through the 80s.